Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the federal land banks right after this. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock, made in Japan, for 6 a.m. While his coffee pot, made in Japan, is perking, he puts his blow dryer, made in Taiwan, to work and shaves with his electric razor, made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt, made in Taiwan, his designer jeans, made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes, made in Korea. Then after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet, made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, made in Mexico, how much he can spend today. Now, after setting his watch, made in Switzerland, to the radio, made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car, made in Germany, goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. Then, after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals, made in Brazil, pours himself a glass, made in France, glass of wine, made in France, turns on his TV, made in Japan, and then ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Or, better yet, if you'll click onto our archives page, you can download that free general law CD package right there. Why don't you try that? That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives and download it right there. All right, we've been talking about this thing of the federal land bank, and the last time when we broke off, I pointed out to you that this is a carefully thought out, deliberate, premeditated, planned outcome. It's based upon an agenda. And when you tell people that, they say, well, you're one of those conspiracy theorists. You know, you have to believe in this conspiracy thing. Well, let's take a look at that for a minute. You're right. You're right. I am a conspiracy theorist, and I don't deny it. You see, I'm also a gambler. And I know that if I walk up to a crap table and I put a bet down on the pass line and I lose, well, I knew that I was either going to lose or I was going to win, because the odds are about 50-50. So I put down a second bet, and I lose again. Well, okay, so the dice are a little cold. But here's what I do know. I know that if I keep putting a bet down there every single time on the pass line, at some point in time, I'm going to win one. I might lose five and win one, lose five and win one, but I do know that I'm going to win once in a while. Now, if I went up to a crap table and I put down 80 bets and I lost 80 times in a row, I would know with absolute certainty that the dice have been fixed. Now, boys and girls, when we go back 80 years to 1920 and we put down a bet every year on the farm program and we lose every single time, 80 times in a row, the fix is in. You can take that to the bank. Now, let's take a look at our politics here for a second as we're studying this thing of the federal land banks and the fix. You ever notice that when politicians are running for office and they talk about education, every politician, whether he's a Republican, a Democrat, a liberal, a conservative, whatever he is, whatever his stripe, when he talks about education, he talks about, we're going to fix it. We're going to raise our test scores. We're going to make sure that there's no child left behind. We're going to give every child an equal opportunity. We're going to hire more teachers, pay them higher wages, and do all these great and wonderful things. You ever notice that? And yet, every single year over the past 80 years, the test scores have been going down. The educational process is getting worse and worse. You take an inner-city public school where they're killing children in school, where they've got vice, where they've got every problem you can imagine in your public school, and they talk about fixing that. They say, well, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. Have you noticed this? The vice gets worse. The violence gets worse. The test scores get worse, and it doesn't make any difference whether you got Arne Duncan in as the Secretary of Agriculture and Barack Obama, or whether you got George Bush or you've got Ronald Reagan. It doesn't make any difference. Let's take energy. Can you remember over the past 30 or 40 years? I mean, we were energy independent up until 1973. We Americans produced enough oil in our country and enough energy that we didn't have to import any, not a barrel. Starting in 1973, when we reached peak oil here in the United States, we had this oil embargo thing come down, and every president from that point on that I can remember has been talking about energy independence, haven't they? I mean, that's Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, and then Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and then George Bush, and Bill Clinton, and George Bush, and now we got Barack Obama, and they're all talking about green energy and more energy and energy independence, haven't they? All right. Have you noticed that every single president, every single politician is talking about energy independence, and we got to solve this energy problem, and it gets worse and worse every single year? Not one president, Republican or Democrat, not one Congress, Republican or Democrat, has done anything about this energy problem. And here's the crazy part. Here in the United States of America, just in the lower 48, we've got 3.6 trillion barrels of oil locked up in the, it's not tar sands here, they got another name for it, out here in the western state. I'll think of the name here for a minute, in a minute. 3.6, and they can get it out for $30 a barrel. Now, we're paying, as I speak, about $80 a barrel for oil. We could get our own oil out of our own land for $30 a barrel. And employ, they figured that they would employ about 2 to 3 million people in the process. Nobody has dug a single barrel of that up over the last 30 or 40 years, and I'll guarantee you they're not going to. All right, that's two. You ever hear him talking about the budget? The president talks about the budget. He talks about balancing the budget. He talks about in the future we're going to have a budget deficit reduction. There hasn't been a balanced budget since, I can't remember. I think there was a balanced budget back in the Eisenhower years, maybe. Maybe it was Truman that balanced it the last time, I can't remember. They talk about balanced budgets, Republicans and Democrats alike, but the results that we get every single year is a deficit. How about the national debt? Every president, don't they talk about the national debt and the need to reduce the national debt or the need to reduce borrowing or the need to do this or that or something else about the national debt? Well, when I was a kid, it was $257 billion right after World War II, and now it's $13.6 trillion and getting worse. They say they expect $19 trillion by, you know, another 5 years. So they talk about it, and they tell you what you want to hear. You know that education is broke, and it needs to be fixed. You know that energy is broke and needs to be fixed. You know the balance is out of whack, and it needs to be fixed. You know that the national debt is out of whack, and it needs to be fixed. And so they come to you, and they say, what about big government? We need to reduce the size of government. Everybody tells you that. Republicans and Democrats. And then when you elect them, guys like George Bush, he gives us the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. So then when you want to change and you vote in Barack Obama, does he come in and say, let's repeal the Patriot Act and Homeland Security? No, not on your life. He comes along and says, I'm going to give you national health care insurance. I'm going to give you a bigger, better bureaucracy than the Homeland Security. You ever notice that? Now, we're about to vote the Democrats out and vote the Republicans in. Do you believe that the Republicans are going to repeal the National Health Care Act? Well, excuse me, boys and girls, when have the Republicans voted any of these socialist acts out when they were in office? I'll guarantee it. I'll put money on it. You're going to elect a Republican Congress, and then probably the next time you'll elect a Republican president, and you look back 10 years from now, and did these Republicans repeal Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, or the National Health Care Act? Go ahead. Put it down on your calendar. Let's see what happens. When we talk about farm income, which is what we're talking about here, don't these politicians all tell you that we need to raise farm income and raise farm income especially for small farmers? And don't they tell you that these farm programs are designed for the protection of and the help to the small farmer? I've never heard a politician say, let's help the multinational corporate farmers. I've never heard a politician say that. He says, let us help the small farmers. Let's have a farm bill here that puts money in the pockets of small farmers in mid-America. And every single time it puts money in the pockets of the multinational corporations, and it bankrupts the little farmers and drives them off the land. Every single time, without fail. It's been going on for 80 years. Boys and girls, if this happened to you on a crap table, you'd say the fix is in. And yet, for 80 years, every one of these political agendas, political problems that we face, they come to us, Republicans and Democrats alike, and they say, we got to fix education, energy, the budget, the national debt, big government, bureaucracy, and farm income. And every single time, no matter who you elect, you get just exactly the opposite. Now, boys and girls, at some point in time, accidentally, you'd have to throw a 7 or 11. It is true, you could throw 13. I think the record in passes is one time back in 1896, I read one time, I think it was in Guinness Books of Records, that some guy threw 26 consecutive passes. The chances of that happening, 26 consecutive winning hands on a crap table, it's in the trillions to one. Never before and never again. I was on a crap table one time in Jackpot, Nevada, and I saw a guy throw 13 winning hands in a row. 13 winning hands in a row. And I was betting the back side of the line, and I bet right into this guy's 13 hands. It happens. I could see 13... losing hands in a row. I've observed that, but I never saw 80 losing hands in a row. And neither has anybody else, and statistically it's impossible, and it's never happened. And yet, it's like Goldman Sachs. I was reading a piece in the paper the other day, and Goldman Sachs is betting, you know, on futures, and they go into the marketplace and they're buying futures, you know, and they bet sometimes long and sometimes short. And somebody in the article said that Goldman Sachs has had a tremendous winning streak. Listen, nobody has a tremendous winning streak without a single loss except Goldman Sachs. Now, when you go into the market and you put in, 20, 30 bids and you win all 20 or 30, the fix is in. Take that one to the bank. The fix is in. You farmers out there, you lose every single time that the Congress passes one of these farm bills. Do you remember the Paperwork Reduction Act Ronald Reagan put in? Okay. Well, now you've got more paper than you've ever had before. Do you remember the presidents of the United States? They always say, well, God bless America. Have you heard that? Oh, except Barack Obama. I've never heard Barack Obama mention God once. I'm not saying he doesn't or didn't, but I've never heard it. But I remember that George Bush, he was constantly saying, God bless America. Remember that? At the very same time that they've banned the Bible, banned God, and banned the Ten Commandments from our schools, our politicians are telling us, God bless America. Let me ask you this, for all of you atheists and so on out there. Can you explain to me why in the hell you'd want to pray to God that doesn't exist? What is it that you're expecting to receive from these prayers? For all you religious people out there, honest to God, do you believe that you can ban the Bible, ban God, and ban the Ten Commandments and get a blessing from it? Does that make any sense? And for all you atheists and communists out there, why in the hell would you want to ask for somebody to pray or to bless America? If this guy doesn't exist, who in the hell is going to do the blessing, and what is the result that you expect to get from the blessing? Now, if there was a God out there, I'd say, well, now that we're in deep trouble, maybe we ought to pray to God. Maybe he'll help us. But I would think that it would be more likely that he would help us if we did something that he told us to do. You know, if I was looking for an inheritance from my Uncle Buster, and I never come to visit him, and I wrote him three letters, and in the three letters that I wrote him, I called him every name that I could think of, and I told him what a no-good, dirty, low-down so-and-so I thought he was. And then one day I heard he was on his deathbed, so I come to visit him, and I, Uncle Buster, I'm so sorry to see that you're sick. Have you named me in your will? Am I going to get part of your estate? I never visited you when you were healthy, and I never cared about you. I cussed you out, and I said every evil and rotten thing I could about you. I did everything I could to thwart you. But now that you're dying, I'd like you to give me your estate or a big portion of it. Huh? Do you believe that that's going to fly? Do you think that we can give our God the finger all these years and then come back and say, well, now, by the way, while you're at it here, God bless America. All right, with that out of the way, let's get on here with the story. You know, the problems with buying and selling of farmlands also arose up to plague the system back in the 1970s. And usually the auction system is employed. The seller retains an auctioneer to sell some farmland, and at the present time, the commission runs around 2 to 5%. That's 2 to 5% of the gross sales price. So the two, that is the seller and the auctioneer, agree on a sale date, and they place an advertisement in the local weekly newspaper, plus at least one in a big Sunday daily paper, some big large city close by. Then a leaflet is mailed to all the post office boxes in the surrounding villages. Well, by 1975, as the profit in the farm belt was just about dried up and disappeared, farmland went for a lot of money. And so the land was sold and bought mostly by farmers. Most of the doctors and lawyers had vanished into their offices long before then, refusing to pay these enormous land prices. Now, most of them did, but not all of them. So when the sale date arrives, a small crowd gathers at the designated spot. A few women show up, but most of the people in the crowd are men. If the sale is to take up most of the day, lunch will be served on the ground, sponsored by a women's group, and the sale always halts for lunch. The auctioneer arrives at the sale at least 30 minutes before starting time so he can work the crowd. We'll call him Wayne. So Wayne goes around and he visits with everyone. Failure to meet and give a friendly greeting to all would be an unforgivable breach of village etiquette. Hi, Joe. How are you? I haven't seen you in ages. What are you doing to keep yourself off the street? Wayne's senseless banter goes on and on. On and on, the chatter flows. As the auctioneer is known by the flow of his chatter, one farmer observes, Wayne's sure full of it today. So Wayne chatters on, Bert's good to see you. I haven't seen you since I went to see your mom and she was making that mulberry jam. Oh, was that good? My teeth fought to get closer to that bread and jam. Oh, my, was that good? Now this goes on until the time of the sale. Then the auctioneer will call everybody's attention to the cloud of dust that's approaching. He opines that it's the loan man from the Federal Land Bank. A short wait occurs as the imported sedan screeches to a halt. Yep, the auctioneer guessed it right. It is. It's the loan man from the local Federal Land Bank Association. Now, we'll call him Jim. This is Jim now. He's college. He's driving around in an imported sports car. He drives it. And it's a big occasion. The Land Bank man is here. Now, Jim's dressed in the latest business suit, and he's wearing T-Texas cowboy boots and a large Western hat, and he can strut sitting down. He's never been on a horse, never milked a cow, wouldn't know what end to start on, but he looks like a cowboy. Okay, boys, Wayne sings, let's get this started. First, I want all of you to meet the owner, Miss Mandy. And as you know, Miss Mandy lost Jake last year, and she's decided to move to town, and so she's put up these two farms for sale. Now, Miss Mandy, come on up and let everybody see you. So she comes up to the podium, and everybody takes a good look at her. She bites back a tear as she's introduced. And the children of the late Jake and Miss Mandy are all introduced to all the bidders, if they have any. Now, it's always escaped me why an auctioneer can call a 70-year-old woman who's been married more than 50 years and has four children Miss, but they do. They always call it Miss, you know, looks like Miss Jackie. But who am I to ask impertinent questions? It's the system. You know, that's the way it is. It's always been that way. It's the system, not the people in it. Now, boys, the auctioneer says, this is good wheat land that we're selling here today. Jake and Miss Mandy made a good living on these places. They lived here 45 years, and that'll tell you how long you have to wait before another opportunity like this comes along, about 45 years. He says, answering to himself, now, so if you want a chance to farm this land in your lifetime, then you better buy today. Boys, that's the way it is. He pauses, and they ain't making no more of it. Land is here, but they ain't making no more of it. Now, wait a minute, you boys back there, step right up here. We want you in on this. Don't wait back there, boys. Just step right on up here, he cajoles. I wish somebody would explain to me why an auctioneer calls men twice his age, you boys, but they do. But they all do that. Probably it's a subtle form of intimidation, a reminder of the farmer's place in the scheme of things. The boys step up, and the auctioneer resumes his senseless chatter. Now, boys, let's sell this farm where we are. It is a 160-acre farm, and 159 of it's in wheat. 1 acre is where these buildings are. It's a good loose loam soil. Wheat grows well here. All minerals go with the land. That's important in the three southern Great Plains states, which have a lot of oil and gas production. Now, boys, what am I bid on this land? He tries for $60,000, and no one responds, and so he goes to $50,000, then to $40,000 before he receives his first bid. Now, the auctioneer's brain finally catches up with his mouth. He says, boys, if it's money, I want to introduce the loan officer of the Federal Land Bank. He's got the money that you may need to buy this farm. Jim, come on up here. Now, this is Jim, and I bet he wants to talk to any buyer here today. Jim agrees that that's his mission here. He's got money to loan and lots of it, and he wants to hit the farmer. He's just here to hit. All right, boys, let's get this thing going, the auctioneer cries. The bidding goes up to 50,000 and stalls. The auctioneer always brings a sidekick whose job it is to work the crowd, scout for bids. Lauren, check with the man. So his sidekick goes over to one of the men who has dropped out and asks why he isn't bidding. The man says he's not certain that he has the money, and he's not certain the land is worth more than $50,000. Not worth it. Are you kidding? The sidekick says, feigning astonishment. They ain't making no more land. This is all there is. If you want more farmland, you're going to have to get in there and buy it. And I'll tell you what. You bid $52,000, and if you get the land and you're not satisfied with the price, I'll give you $1,000 and take the land myself. In other words, you'll get $1,000 for your effort and all of the land. Okay, the farmer says, his voice not quite sure. Yipe, the sidekick yelps to the auctioneer. I got a bid for 52 right here. Now, this practice is called picking a bid out of the air. It's as dishonest as a dog's hind leg. It's as crooked as a dog's hind leg. Yet practiced by scores of auctioneers and their sidekicks from Texas and North Dakota. In fact, many of these auctions are only one step away from outright fraud. Now, the auctioneer looks at the previous bidder who bids it up to 53. The sidekick goes to another bidder who has long since dropped out and asks him for a bid. The farmer shakes his head no. The sidekick asks if it's money, and the farmer shakes his head yep. Don't you remember the sidekick badgers him? Wayne told you at the start of the loan, that the loan man from the Federal Land Bank is here, and that if you needed money, Jim would get it for you. In fact, I suggest you bid 55, and if you get it, and the Federal Land Bank won't loan you the money, and I'll take it and give you $1,000 for your time. Do you really think the Federal Land Bank will loan the money, the farmer asks? Oh, yeah, they will, says the sidekick. 95% of all farm loans today are made by the Federal Land Bank. The man bids 55. Yipe, 55, the sidekick barks. And who'll give me 60? Now, the auctioneer wants to know. The sidekick works the crowd for another bid. There are none. The auctioneer speaks, his voice is grave and paternal. Now, boys, we ain't going to let this land go for $55,000. That'd be stealing it, not selling it. I said this land was to be sold, not stolen, and I'm not going to let anybody steal this land. Now, boys, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn this squawk box, that's his megaphone, off, and then let's visit about this. And then we'll come back and we'll sell the land, but it won't be for $55,000. The squawk box is turned off, and the loan officer of the Federal Loan Bank, Federal Land Bank Association, steps forward to ply his dubious trade. Now, by then, there are only two serious bidders, so he visits with both of them. This land is worth a lot more than the bid is here, he tells the first bidder. Now, if you want the land, the Federal Land Bank will loan you the money for it. I believe I can get you 100% financing. Are you sure you can finance it for me, the farmer asks. No, sure I can, says the loan man. Look, if you want this land, just bid it on up, and then I'll approve your loan before I leave here today. You've got credit with the Federal Land Bank, he adds. We'll back you. Isn't that fair enough? Now, the farmer grins a grin as wide as the Mississippi River. All of his life, He said he could do better if he had a line of credit. And now this nice man, Jim, from the Federal Land Bank is telling him that that's just what he always wanted to hear. You may see me bidding a little faster, he says. Well, goodbye. Good boy. The Federal Land Bank man says, and the word again here is a college graduate who cannot properly address another human being and falls into the evil habit of calling grown men, in this case, a 72-year-old man, boy. Boy. Now the Land Bank man goes to the second bidder and he talks with him. Jim asks if he needs credit. Farmer said probably not. His wife just inherited some money from a great aunt back in Pennsylvania, so he has most of the money he needs. Good, but if you need any money, will you let us finance it for you? And will you give us first shot at it? You have credit with us, the Land Bank operator says, and I mean operator, the way it was meant in old gangster movies. I'll see what I can do, the farmer replies. Now consider what's going on here. The loan officer eagerly agrees to finance both sides of the bidding so that they can purchase this property. Note here, he doesn't even know their names. The loan committee knew everyone in the days of the small associations, but this loan officer is going out of his way to lend money to people whose names he doesn't even know, whose creditworthiness is a complete mystery to him. Now here the system reveals one of its major evils. By agreeing to finance each bidder as they bid against each other, the Land Bank officer drives the price of land upward, floating on a cushion of his own hot air. No representatives of insurance companies or commercial banks ever conduct themselves this way. In fact, the insurance companies and the banks aren't even at the sale. Once the Land Bank man is through working the two bidders, and oftentimes third, fourth, or fifth bidders, the auctioneer turns on his squawk box and the bidding resumes. They quickly bid the farm up to $100,000 and it sells to the first farmer. Now the Land Bank officer and the auctioneer's sidekick rush over to congratulate the buyer. The auctioneer then calls for the sale of the second farm and uses exactly the same stunt to double its price. Now the Federal Land Bank officer approves both loan applications for the sale and the purchase of the land before he leaves the sale grounds. No credit checks are run, no income taxes monitored to see if the farmer's operation is profitable. Knowing next to nothing about the farmers, the Federal Land Bank contracts to lend them a total of $200,000. The farmers put up no cash to close the sales. So why do these loan officers at the Federal Land Bank system conduct themselves in such a disgraceful fashion? Well, one thing the Farm Credit Act of 1971 stated was that the system should be independent of all other federal departments. Consequently, the men who ran the system decided to crowd out all of the other lenders by socializing the long-term credit system that is used by the farmer. To make their loan officers more aggressive, the Federal Land Bank system offered its loan officers commissions based on both the number and the size of the loans they made. Further augmenting the loan officer strategy were fringe benefits, free trips to Reno, vacations to Hawaii, Bermuda, and other garden spots. That's called bribery. Now in the Bible, God tells you not to take a gift because it perverts the eyes of the wise. And here we have just plain outright bribery, just like we do with our politicians giving them campaign contributions. Now, the question that you and I need to ask is, well, who's promoting this and why? Who's promoting this and why? Well, now, the guys that are promoting this are these secret societies. You know, the Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission, Skull and Bones. What's the purpose behind it? Why would you want to make bad loans to people? Well, now, if your agenda called for bankrupting the farmers, politically we come out and we say, we're here to help you small farmers. But what if our real agenda, like a spy, isn't to help the farmer? It's to win his confidence and bankrupt him. That's our real agenda. What better way could there be than to drive up the prices of the land so that the farmer can't pay for it? And here's the best part. Remember, the 1916 Act calls for joint and several liability. Now, this word is a legal term, joint and several liability. Remember, I showed you this yesterday. What happens is that as these farmers buy in here, they have to put up collateral. And so they have to sign their home farms over to the Federal Land Bank as collateral for these new farms that they're buying. Yeah. So you got to have collateral. You don't have to have any money. We'll give you 100% financing, but you got to have collateral. And so I've got a home farm that's I'm fourth generation farmer, and I've inherited this from my dad, who inherited it from his dad, who inherited it from his dad, who probably homesteaded it back in the 1880s. And so now I put my home farm up as collateral for this new farm that I'm buying, and I've just bid the price up to double what this farm's going to produce. And I've signed up for joint and several liability, which is a legal term nobody understands. And so what this boils down to is the Federal Land Bank can't lose. They're going to end up with all the land. Because when this farmer can't make his payments, it's no big deal because all the other farmers that are in the association have to make up the loss. And when this thing snowballs and they can't make the payments and they can't cover the losses of the other farmers, the Land Bank comes in and seizes all of the land. Then they turn around and sell it to Archer Daniels Midland, or they sell it to John Hancock Insurance Corporation, or insurance company. And they make these humongous farms, you know, with 15, 20, 30, 50,000 acres, corporate farms, big state-run farms, just like they have in Russia. They socialize it. Communal farming is what that boils down to. It's the state actually ends up owning it. Well, the state owns it because the state creates the corporations. You know, I was a kid one time, and then I had a bicycle, 11 years old, And if you would have asked me whose bike that was, I would have said, that's my bike. Well, one day I misbehaved, and my daddy said, you're grounded. Put your bike up on the porch. You're walking. Now, let me ask you, whose bike was that? See, my daddy owned me, and he owned my bike. So when the state creates a corporation, and you want to know who owns Archer Daniels Midland, the United States government. Who chartered Archer Daniels Midland? The United States government. So the guy that's in control of the United States government is the guy that owns Archer Daniels Midland. And who's in control of the United States government? The secret society, Skull and Bones. The Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, the CFR, Learned Elders, Knights of Malta. See, it's a simple program, and the objective in the program is to bankrupt the farmers so that the state can take over ownership of all the land. We're trying to drive the farmers off the land and into the cities. Now, look at how the plan has worked. In 1922, half the people of the country, nearly half, 44%, lived on the land. Today, it's below 2 million. They have driven off of the land 42 million people between 1920 and 2010. It's a program that has worked every single year without interruption, 80 consecutive times. Boys and girls, the fix is in. Wake up and smell the coffee. Now, in 1916, the legislation that set up the federal land banks was allowed, or it did allow them to lend, only up to 50% of the land's appraised value. Congress raised the figure to 65% in 46 and made loans from the Veterans Administration available to the ex-GIs who wanted to buy farms and farmhouses. Under the Farm Credit Act of 1971, loans could be made up to 85% of the appraised value. This last increase flooded the countryside with excessive credit. By 1987, the federal land banks had foreclosed on considerable amounts of land, leaving a big backlog of farms that they couldn't sell. Congress meekly raised the lending power of the banks to 97% of the appraised price, and because Congress had established in 1971 that the appraised price of such property was whatever the banks wanted it to be, the land banks didn't have to follow state or federal laws, remember, or real estate trade practices when deciding the value of the land. Congress handed the land bank officers a very large cookie jar, and they proceeded to rate it of every crumb. Now, over the decades, the term appraised price has acquired a definite legal meaning. It means the best price that can be received for the land. Appraisers determine the figure by researching the price of similar land in the area, adding or subtracting as needed for improvements, such as fences and buildings and soil specifics, whether it's terraced or not, and so on. Now, when the farms sold at the auction described above went for $100,000 apiece, this tended to adjust the appraised price of other farms in the area upward, where the federal land bankers apparently wanted them. But why should that have happened? The fair market value of the land was actually $50,000 apiece, remember? Now, remember how the bidding rose to $50,000 and stalled? That's because the fair market value of this land actually was $50,000. That's what these farmers knew that they could buy it for and then farm it, make a profit, and pay this mortgage and interest. They knew that. So clearly, the auctioneer's sidekick and the land bank loan operator kited up the sales price. The latter was willing to finance all of the bidders, and no loan officers from other institutions even appeared. The insurance companies that traditionally made these long-term loans to farmers have long since removed themselves from the competition. The federal land bank, and only the federal land bank, now gets the action. That's not an accident. That's part of the agenda. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you, if I can find my paper. What did I do? Here he is right here. Let me give you a mid-course reminder here so that we can settle up here with the Federal Communications Commission and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I'm talking about the federal land banks over here. Now, let me bring your attention to Leviticus 25 in the Bible. Leviticus 25, talking about the price of land. First of all, in Leviticus 25, 23, it tells us the land shall not be sold forever, because the land is mine and you're strangers and sojourners upon it. The buying, selling, and trading of this land is a criminal activity in violation of that statute. That's right. Now, sometimes people will ask me, well, how much is your farm here worth, Mr. Gordon? And I tell them it's worth nothing, zero. And they look at me with astonishment, and they say, well, surely it must be worth a lot of money. It's farmland. And I tell them, no. No, there's a collateral estoppel here. You can't sell this land. Buying, selling, and trading lands against the law. So how come we have real estate brokers then in real estate salesmen? They're all licensed, aren't they? And a license is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So if you've got a license in your pocket to sell land, well, then you ought to know right then and there it violates some law somewhere. And that's the definition of the license that you're carrying. A license is a criminal activity, whatever it is. Marriage license, driver's license, business license, it's a criminal activity by definition. And people, you know, they participate in it. It's the only thing they know. It's the only thing the public school ever taught them. They never taught them the other side of it. Now, the other side of this is that there's a Ten Commandment model. And on this Ten Commandment model over here, that land should have gone to the firstborn son of Mandy and Jake, remember? Now they're going to convert that to dollars so that they can consume it upon their lust. They're going to buy a new car or something with it. And the value of the land, yeah, it's got a value. In fact, Leviticus 25 tells you how to compute the value of land. What you do is you count the number of years to the Jubilee, and then the value of the land is, well, what will it produce between now and the Jubilee? And if it'll produce $100,000, well, then it's worth $100,000. If it'll produce $50,000, well, then it's worth $50,000. But in the Jubilee, it always goes back to Mandy and her firstborn son. It always goes back to the family. And why is that? It's against the law to make merchandise of your inheritance. An inheritance is a gift. If I gave you a Christmas present and you took it out and you sold it, wouldn't I be miffed? Put the shoe on the other foot. You give me a Christmas present and I take your Christmas present out to the pawn shop and I pawn it so I can get the cash. Wouldn't you be a little miffed? Now, God's told us not to buy, sell, and trade this land, and we said, well, we got a better program than that. Well, okay. Now, look what's happened to us. We didn't want to practice the Ten Commandment model. And we fell victim to our own vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. This farmer now, remember, the land was worth $50,000. Had he paid $50 for it, he could have farmed it and probably paid for it. But he did double that. Now, remember I told you at the beginning of the program, I said, this isn't an accident. We're not dealing with ignorance, foolishness, bad policy, Democrats, Republicans, parity or low parity, or communists and socialists and capitalists and so on, that we blame all of our woes on. This is an agenda. This is a deliberate, premeditated, pre-planned outcome. There's an agenda here. And here's how it works. At the very same time in the 1970s, Congress enacts this new farmland bill, land bank bill. And the land banks, now they're going out here and they're selling this land now and bidding the price up to double. Remember, they got joint and several liability. Meanwhile, the agriculture department, you know, the outfit that's here to save the little farmer, they go into Congress and say, hey, what we need over here is higher farm price supports. Congress passes the act and the price of soybeans hits $12 a bushel. $12 a bushel will support this land at $100,000. Remember, the normal price for soybeans is $4 or $5 a bushel and will support land prices at $50,000. So the Agriculture Department and Congress jack the price of soybeans up to $12. Now you can pay $100,000 for the land because it'll support $100,000. So now you've got the land bank, the Department of Agriculture, and the secret societies working together to formulate a plan to suck the farmers in. Now, the farmers during the 1970s are sucked in. 1984, Congress drops the price supports on soybeans, and the price of soybeans dropped from $12 down to $4 or $5. And now the farmers cannot pay the mortgage. So the farmers, they don't give up just the land that they bought. Remember, they've got their home farms now, their home places, put up as collateral. So the land bank comes in, forecloses on the home farm, as well as the one you bought. Yeah, but it's better than that. It's better than that because these farmers have joint and several liability. The other farmers who are solvent, who haven't gone the extra mile and bought up these farms and overextended themselves, remember, they've got joint and several liability with all the bad farmers that went out and bought this land and then bankrupted themselves, and so they drag the solvent farmers into bankruptcy. Now, along comes John Hancock, and they make a deal with the Federal Land Bank, and they say, hey, we'll take all this land off your hands over here at these discounted prices, just like they're doing right now. They played this same game with the homeowners. And Alan Greenspan went out here and made all these bad loans to you people, remember, in the 90s and early 2000s and said, hey, buy all this. We want to make homeowners. George Bush said, we want everybody in America to be a homeowner. Remember? And they went out here and they made all these liar loans and they got all these people involved in all this. And now the real estate market's collapsed. And so the solvent people in the nation, the people who had jobs and had a house and they were making their payments. But now watch what happens. With all of these houses on the market, it has depressed the market. So now they bid the prices of these houses up $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. My God, you people thought you were getting rich. Then they started foreclosing. Now they got about 4 million houses on the market. I saw a piece on the TV last night. This kid paid $270,000 for a condominium in Florida. And right now he can buy one across the street for $45,000. So what's happened here is a deliberate, premeditated plan. This is a carefully thought-out plan that doesn't just involve the Federal Land Bank. It involves the Congress, the Federal Land Bank, the Department of Agriculture, the secret societies, the President of the United States, and all of these people working together formulated a plan to help the farmers, to suck them into a trap. Then when they sucked them all in, and they closed the gate and they had them trapped. It's worked perfectly. It worked for the farmers. It's worked for the homeowners, you know, all the people that have mortgages on their houses. Now, this depression that you see going on today is a carbon copy of the same depression of 1929 to 33. The numbers are actually working out to be just about parallel. If you take a look at 1929, 30, 31, 32, and 33, and you take a look at 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, just, you know, extrapolated out into the future, numbers are working the same. My prediction would be that we'll have just about the same depression we had in the 30s, just about the same time frame from the time that the stock market collapsed the first time until it collapses the second time, about an 89-90% loss. Unemployment, 25%. It's already here. In fact, I saw a number last night. I think it was in the International Forecaster. They took a survey. They just started calling people across the country, 1,500 people, asked them, you know, if they had anybody unemployed in their house. 28% said they got one or more people looking for a job. Now, the Department of Labor tells you, well, you've got a 9.5% unemployment rate. They're not lying. They're telling you the truth. Unemployment's 9.5%. That's called U5, I believe it is. That's the number of people that are actively drawing unemployment insurance. U5. What they don't tell you is that there's U1, U2, U3, U4, and U6. U6, that's the number of people that are unemployed whose unemployment's run out. So if your unemployment runs out, they don't count you as unemployed, whether or not you've got a job. Now, the way we used to track this is we'd go out and ask people, are you looking for a job? Yeah, I'm looking for a job. Now, if somebody were to call my house, and we've got three members here, my wife, myself, and Dirk, and if they ask the question, do you have anybody in your household that's looking for a job, our answer would be no. No, nobody here is looking for a job. And then if they ask the question, is there anybody there that's employed, we'd answer, nope, there's nobody here that's employed. And we're not employed, and we're not looking for a job. But if they called your house, what would your answer be? Would it be, well, yeah, we're looking for a job. And yeah, there's two of us that are looking for a job. Or no, there's none of us looking for a job. That'll tell you how many unemployed there are. Now, the numbers that we get out of government are lies. That's right, they're lies. They're lying to you. They're giving you the best possible story. They're telling you what you want to hear. And what you want to hear is that we're working on the energy project. We're trying to develop energy independence. And the president, he's out here telling you we're just building windmills everywhere, trying to make America energy independent. No, he's not. No, he's not. Not trying to do that at all. The president's involved in an agenda to make America energy dependent and more dependent. And as time progresses, we will become more and more energy dependent, not less and less energy dependent. The president's telling you, hey, we're working on education. We're trying to make your kids smarter, cut costs, and improve and increase profits. No, he's not. He's trying to dumb your kid down, and he's doing everything he can to create more and more violence in the public schools and to make it worse and worse and poorer and to dumb your kid down. And that's been going on for the last 80 years. And so is this energy thing. And the budget. He talks about, hey, we're going to cut the budget deficit. No, he's not. No, he's not. He's going to increase the budget deficit until the country goes into insolvency. That's his agenda. That's what he's there for. That's what he's hired for. Now, he's telling you the exact opposite because that's what you want to hear. National debt, we're going to reduce or eliminate. Big government, we're going to reduce the size of big government. Bureaucracy, we're going to reduce or control the size of bureaucracy. Farm income, we're going to raise the farm income of little farmers. We're here to save small farms. That's our purpose and goal. That's what you're going to hear from the president. Business, we're here to promote small business. Now, remember I told you yesterday, back in 1978 or 79, I got a letter from the SBA, and they said, hey, we'll loan you $500,000 if you'll move your operation from Boise, Idaho to Juarez, Mexico, into the free trade zone. Boys and girls, this is a deliberate, premeditated, pre-planned outcome. This is for the purposes of offshoring and outsourcing our jobs. And the president says, we've got to stop this outsourcing and offshoring. No, no, there hasn't been. This president's been in office now for a year and a half. Not one bill has gone to Congress to stop any outsourcing or offshoring. Not one bill has been introduced. And when we get through with the end of Barack Obama's tenure in office, he will have outsourced as many or more jobs than George Bush did. And George Bush was in the process of outsourcing and offshoring jobs faster than Bill Clinton. It doesn't have anything to do with politics. It has to do with the secret societies. It has to do with the protocols of the learned elders, boys and girls. This is a pre-programmed plan which was hatched in 1884, and then probably before then. One rabbi said that they've been doing this for 3,000 years. But at least we know since 1884. And you can sit there and argue with me and say, well, you racist anti-Semite dog, you. I'm sitting here saying, son, wake up and smell the coffee. It doesn't make any difference what your politics are, your religion. It's already a done deal. You've already outsourced the jobs. Your kid is already dumbed down. This public education system here costs us $10,000 a kid to educate them in public school. And they're dumber and dumber and dumber every year. And if you educated your kid at home, it would cost you $600 a year. If you educated him in a Catholic school, it would cost you $2,500. And the kid would be able to read and write. And the kid wouldn't be dumbed down. The more money you spend on education, the poorer the outcome becomes. And the more you vote for these guys, then the faster and faster, and worse the outcome becomes. And that's because it's already a pre-programmed, deliberate, premeditated agenda. Wake up. Smell the coffee. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.